This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Genocide and colonization are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hello and welcome back to AusPulse NACPod, the podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news with a side of crispy memes. And we're also the official podcast of the AusPulse Shitposting Facebook group, which you can find at facebook.com/groups/AusPulse Shitposting. Answer the questions or you won't get let into the group. I'm Noon, I'm the admin and creator of AusPulse Shitposting, and with me is my co-host and confidant,
Zach Lesnack. How are you going, everybody? Thanks for tuning in. It has been a shit week of news. But thankfully, it's that special time of year. It's rolled around again. I think you know what I'm talking about.
That big public festival, 7-day, that we're all celebrating.
That we all love to participate in. The 7-day festival of unleavened bread.
Yeah.
So happy Pesach to you and yours.
I hope everyone who's listening has been let out of the house of bondage and that their people will not be continually enslaved by Pharaoh.
I hope that your bread is unleavened by choice and not because you are stranded in the desert.
I actually literally just made like regular leavened bread this morning. So, you know, bad Jew. But happy Pesach, Chag Sameach, Lekulam, everyone.
Yeah, what he said.
Yeah.
We also wanted to shout out
Pesach. It's great.
I don't think anybody wants to hear that. Thank you to Hypatia Text Protocol, who has upped their pledge on Patreon. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. We also wanted to mention that we are only 4 patrons away from our 50-patron goal, which when we hit it, we're going to do a small short-run series of Noon and the Dunce, where Noon explains a bunch of Marxist theory to me through the lens of memes that I do not understand but find hilarious nonetheless.
Yeah. Can so I just say, Noon and the Dunce is absolutely Zach's title for this. I would not pick such a self-aggrandizing or Zach belittling title, but, you know, I mean, we're here now. So. But yeah, I've already got all my memes ready. I'm real hyped to do that. So yeah, please hop on Patreon and give us a buck.
Yeah, if you want to give us a buck, that would help us out a whole bunch. We really appreciate it. Cool.
Should we dive into our entree?
Yeah, let's do it. Having a bit of a tropical entree this week. You guys may have heard about NRL Island, which is a plan to keep the NRL going by creating a special little bubble off the coast of Queensland where all of the players and officials and medical staff will live for the entirety of the season. I realize that there's probably like a lower percentage of sports fans in our listenership than might be represented in the general population.
Yeah, that's probably
so
a good bet.
For anyone who doesn't know, the NRL obviously stands for National Rugby Lovers. So that's just the club for people who really, really love rugby.
There was a great quote on the ABC, I think it was a week or two ago before this NRL Island thing was even going, where they just, you know, it was the news bulletin on the hour or whatever, and it was like, oh yeah, more people dying, everything is shutting down, no one's allowed to leave the house, and then now to sports news, and some guy was like, oh yeah, well the boys have been training really hard, they're excited to play some footy, so I think we're just going to do it, even though there's this virus thing going on. But yeah, I love the idea of just moving the entire code off to an island. Like, I've had
amazing
fantasies
special
about
NRL Love Island.
About, like, you know, secession from Australia and microstates, you know, First Nations sovereignty overthrowing the colonial government and stuff. But who would have thought that it was the comrades at the NRL who would finally deal the death blow to the nation state as a, like, institution?
Oh, shit. Yeah, so it's not just NRL Island. You're talking NRL nation state. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Okay.
Fine. Whoever wins the grand final is the, you know, dictator until the end of the next season. I think it's a great concept.
There's so much about this that is funny, aside from the name NRL Island, which is just obviously great. One of the pleasures has been, as you just sort of hinted at, hearing a whole bunch of serious media commentators have to basically pretend like this is an issue that needs to be debated and discussed. And we need to weigh up the costs and benefits. And, this could be the way forward for sporting codes around the world. Australia could be the trailblazer. And, like, No, the NRL is just completely fucking mismanaged and headed up by a bunch of people who are really bad at their jobs.
Yeah.
And somebody just, like, literally, it's a couple of people just, like... It's definitely two people sitting in a room. One's like, NRL Island. The other person's like, you son of a bitch.
That's I'm in.
Just crazy enough to work. And I just, one of the things I wanted to just mention in regards to mismanagement of the NRL, which I just found really funny, is that they have this ongoing contract with Channel 9 and Foxtel to broadcast the games. And Channel 9 put out a statement the other day, basically just trashing the NRL management, which I just thought was really funny. They said, Nine has invested hundreds of millions in this game over decades, and we now find they have profoundly wasted those funds with very little to fall back on to support the clubs, the players, and supporters. We've bailed them out many times, including a $50 million loan to support clubs when the last contract was signed. It would now appear that much of that has been squandered by a bloated head office completely ignoring the needs of the clubs, players, and supporters. You've just got basically a bunch of people just absolutely pissing away cash and yeah. who've driven this code into the ground and are now like,
hey, could you fund us to move to a small island?
We're just going to move to an island. And the other thing about it I find really funny is, like, if you're going to do it, fucking lean in, please, okay? And the moment the idea is that all the players and everybody are just going to live on the island and then they're going to get ferried by boat back to Brisbane
to play the games.
You fucking cowards, play the games on the island. No one gets let off until their team wins the final,
also,
and then they get to rejoin regular society.
A reality TV show just following them around? I think, you know, that's the money spinner for Channel 9. You know, forget the actual games, but just the, yeah.
National Rugby Lovers Island. Yeah. That's what I've been saying.
There was one other little sports news thing that I wanted to mention, which is about the UFC. And again, probably our listenership is, yeah, a little... underrepresented in UFC fans, I'm guessing, but there was a fight that's been sort of planned for, I think, years of, like, two of the top fighters in the world, a guy called Khabib, who has a very long, difficult, like, Balkan last name, versus Tony Ferguson, and they were scheduled to fight, I think, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, but I'm pretty sure it was in New York, and the venue got shut down because, you know, coronavirus, and so the UFC were like, cool, we'll move it to Las Vegas, where rules are less important, and then eventually Las Vegas was like, no, you can't do that. So they decided to move it to some tribal lands where, like, federal U.S. law doesn't apply in the same way, and then the tribal owners found out that that was planned, and they were like, no, please don't do that. So then it got moved to, I'm pretty sure, like a fake, like an artificial island off the coast of the Arabian Peninsula that's like owned by a sultan. But then Khabib got stuck in Russia, so and is like quarantined and unable to fly out. So that fight has finally been done. But as with the NRL, it's just like, why the fuck would you think this fight or this game was more important than just like, just locked down for a bit? It's fine.
The spread of the virus? Yeah, no, it's like, that is ultimately, I think, the wildest thing about this story is that, like, it's funny that the first people to go full apocalypse, we're just going to create our own new bubble where no one is allowed in around.
Yeah.
It was a sports club, yeah. Like sports code. maybe they've had this NRL island idea just like sitting
ready
on a
to
shelf,
go. Yeah.
And they just, someone just, as soon as the corona hit, they just slapped the big red NRL island button, like, it's time. We're doing it.
Look, I know this was our entree, but I think we're actually late for our your least favorite sting. Do you wanna hit that?
Yes, I'll play it. Hey man, I got some more beers.
Oh, I don't know if I can drink anymore. I'm feeling kind
of
sick.
Now come on, we're having another round of Coronas. So the main thing I wanted to talk about this week with regards to Corona is the government's JobKeeper package, which we mentioned last week. And kind of had a brief conversation about whether or not it kind of counts as like a second tier of welfare, which, look, I'm willing to walk my position on that back a little bit after reading a little bit more into it. Cool. Well, we're both wrong. I agree with you completely in that regard.
Great.
So the JobKeeper package has been passed by the government. They had a special sitting day, a single day sitting of parliament. This has been claimed as a big victory by the ACT, the Australian Council of Trade Unions. So, you know, the big union that represents all unions kind of thing. And as we discussed last week, this is a payment that's going to go to businesses of $1,500 a fortnight for 6 months. And this is to help businesses who can't currently pay their employees to pay them. So I guess, when we were talking about it last week, we were sort of framing it as like, it's a welfare payment that is kind of keeping people off the books on welfare, keeping them employed, helping them cook the numbers and that kind of thing. But I read this week a piece from Lisbeth Latham.
Friend of the show. Friend of the
show. And
member of Inner
Member of our Inner Sanctum for sure. And I'm going to be cribbing from her article on this as well, which we'll link in the show notes. And I highly recommend that people read if you want to get a little bit more of an overview from the perspective of somebody who knows a lot more about labor rights than we do. But so the way that this is going to work, employers, in order to qualify, have to show that they've lost a significant amount of revenue, and there's different amounts that you have to show that you've lost depending on how much money you've got coming in. But it's a fair chunk, 30 to 50%, I'm pretty sure. But for workers to qualify, it's got actually quite narrow delineations, I guess. So to qualify as a worker, you have to be either a permanent or fixed-term employee who was employed before the 1st of March, or a casual who's been working for your employer for over a year. So that obviously rules out a huge amount of the casualized workforce, because part of the point
who
of
the fuck
casual
casuals
work,
at the same place for more than a year, right? Like, that's ridiculous.
It's very rare, and obviously it's going to exclude a number of, for example, international students, or people, migrants on working visas, or anybody who's worked casually at a place for less than a year. Like, say you've been working somewhere for 11 months, you just don't fucking qualify. So for about 30% of the people who will get this payment, this will be like equal to or more than what they normally get paid, but for everyone else, it's going to represent a wage cut. So one of the kind of things to note about this is that the $1,500 that goes to the business is not in, like, it doesn't go then to the worker as a supplement on top of what they earn.
Yeah, it's instead.
So it's paying the business for the money that they would normally give to that employee. So it's really functioning as a subsidy for businesses.
Absolutely.
Not for workers. And of course, this is like the way that a neoliberal government is going to implement a social safety net. If they have the opportunity, they're going to make it go through business. And obviously and I think we sort of fell for this a little bit last week when we were discussing it as a kind of welfare payment.
Well, I think that's kind of what my point was last week, though I guess I'm also more critical of it now. But my point was that it's not exactly a second tier of welfare, because it's not really welfare in the same sense. It's actually a subsidy for business, as you say. And that's bad, and it should be welfare instead, or it should be going to the workers instead. I think that's kind of where I was coming from last week about saying it's not a separate tier in that it's not actually going to the workers particularly at all.
No, although as we discussed last week as well, like that $1,500 that the government has decided is like what people who were previously employed should get does represent like, like why do they think that people on JobSeeker can survive on less? So that's one thing to keep in mind,
or
obviously.
People on disability support,
Who are also not getting extra money, which is fucked. The other thing to note about this is that it comes with a few changes to the Fair Work Act, which basically makes it easier for employers to fuck around their employees. Yeah. So it makes it easy for them to change the amount of hours that people work. Makes it much easier for them to direct workers to take leave, or even take leave at half pay. They can change the location that people work. But they're still going to be getting that $1,500. So if they're encouraging workers to take leave or leave at half pay, which means that if they have to stand people down completely and then pay out their leave, it'll be cheaper for them in the long run.
Totally.
So that's kind of one sort of sneaky thing that was pointed out by Hill Montato on the AusPol Shareposting Facebook group. So this will still go to people who have been stood down. Like there, so there are a number of people who will get this who like wouldn't be getting paid otherwise. So that's obviously a positive thing. But for people who are still working, this basically means that the government is just subsidizing the business's expenses when it comes to wages. Because for the people who are receiving the payment, it's if they earn more than $1,500 in a fortnight normally, that's what they're going to get paid. For a few, and as we mentioned earlier, for about 30% of workers who would earn less than the $1,500 normally in a fortnight, they'll get the full $1,500. So it'll be a slight pay increase. But obviously, you know, there's a number of gaps in this plan, and I think it's pretty cynical in a number of ways. I guess I wonder about the wisdom of the ACTU claiming it as a massive victory, because there a lot of people are falling through the gaps, and a lot of those people are people who are already in casualized or unstable employment. And you know, we already know that it's all those people already struggle to get good industrial relations representation, because it's much harder to unionize those kind of atomized workforces, especially if you're working for in the gig economy, for example, where you're not even technically a casual.
I also just wanted to say briefly before we move on that this reminds me of something that I like to say often, is a cynical point that most welfare is actually welfare for landlords. Like Centrelink basically is a payment to landlords that goes via the welfare recipient's bank account. Yep, that's my whole point. But yeah, this is just another thing of like, you know, sure, the money is ending up with the workers, but what it's actually doing is paying the businesses. So yeah, yet another way for conservative governments to use welfare to promote the interests of businesses. Yeah.
Very cool. Nice to see that sort of response to a crisis.
Speaking of nice responses.
Yeah, let's play that sting. Fashy Australia.
That's two beer-related stings in a row. Well, this is basically about the cops have expanded powers at the moment, and presumably many of those powers will remain as the situation continues. One of the really horrifying things from my point of view is that PSOs, the ticket inspectors, have been given more powers in Victoria. And basically the way that this has happened is that they've expanded the area that counts as near public transport. So PSOs have the power to like ask you for your like my key or, you know, your ticket if you're anywhere within like 10 meters of a station, a train station or a tram stop, basically. I think it's 10 meters. But now that's been expanded significantly, so people further away will also come under the purview of the PSOs. And it's something we haven't actually talked about very much on the show, but I used to be the admin of Where Are Our Mates, which was a Facebook page for keeping an eye on ticket inspectors in Victoria. And the PSOs in Melbourne are violent thugs. They were in the paper a few years ago for beating up a school kid. They like someone like choked out a kid at St Kilda Station because he didn't have his train pass, which I always say, like, you know, if someone's desperate enough for free public transport to wear a school uniform, just fucking let them have it, you know, like, who gives a shit?
Jesus Christ. No, for real. And like the other thing to note, like, no amount of training makes a good cop, but these people are given weapons and powers that are very extreme, with very, very little training, like a matter of months of training, and then they're given weapons and sent out into the community.
Another issue is about there was a learner driver fined for going out learning to drive. The cops have been walking that back a bit. I missed that. I only saw the initial story.
Yeah, so this kid was fined for taking a driving lesson with her mum because the cops pulled them over and said that it was unessential travel. And then that story kind of blew up in the news, and they basically have since declared that doing driving lessons for L-platers will count as essential travel.
Right.
But look, it's another case of the laws being different state to state and there being a huge amount of confusion with what does and doesn't count as essential travel or what the cops can fine you for. And of course, as we mentioned last week, a lot of this is just down to police discretion. And it's sort of, it's early days at this stage. Like, the amount of fines that have been given out are, like, just, you know, in the triple digits at this stage, and it really varies state to state. New South Wales is giving out fines at a rate of only like 1/3 of what Victoria is at the moment.
I've got a tweet here from Osman Faruqi.
What I was going to say was, it's early days, but we are seeing some patterns emerge in the distribution of those fines, whether or not they're being, you know, given to people in the areas where the most contraventions of the isolation regulations are happening, or whether they're happening in already over police communities. So yeah, I just wanted to preface before you read that, Osman, those stats, that we're talking in relatively small real numbers here, but the statistics are still telling, and we'll kind of try to keep track of them as more info comes out. But what did Osman have to say?
Yeah, so this was on April 5th, and Osman Faruqi says this. Been working on collating New South Wales police data for COVID-19 fines and arrests, and here's some initial analysis. 33% of infringements have been issued in southwest Sydney. Coonamble, 1 in 3 residents are Indigenous, has 0.04% of the state's population, but 10% of infringements. The top 4 local government areas with the most locally acquired COVID-19 cases, excluding the CBD, which are Waverley, Northern Beaches, Inner West, and Randwick, have a total of 1 infringement. 23% of locally acquired COVID cases, 1 infringement. And that one case from DY wasn't because police were out patrolling, but one man who kept rocking up to the police station to visit his mate before police eventually fined him.
Yeah, apparently he came to see his friend and the cops were like, no, you can't be here, go home. And he came back a few hours later with a drink and the smoke and was like, oh, I just popped in to see my mate. And they were like,
buddy,
fine you.
Yeah. It's shocking. I mean, it's not shocking. It's completely unsurprising that police are using these powers to fine people in poor and Indigenous areas and ignoring people being shitty in Newtown and Bondi, you know?
Yeah. And in Victoria, fining protesters as well. There was a motorcade protest happening outside the Mantra Hotel in Preston, where a number of asylum seekers who were being held in indefinite detention are being held at the moment. The cops wouldn't find them. It was like $1,600 each or something. I don't know. I saw some conversation on the page from people being like, well, why, you know, they knew that they were going to get fined. They were warned about getting fined and they went and did it anyway. And that betrays wealth privilege on the part of the protesters, which like, okay, maybe yes, but that is definitely not the main issue here. The main issue is the cops using these powers to
crack
harass
down on
protesters.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're taking advantage of the murkiness over whether or not it's okay to be in your car.
Yeah, yeah.
To find people, you know, and I think we'll find in the weeks to come that they'll have to walk that shit back in the same way that they
have.
Yeah,
it's going to be a lot of appeals for these fines.
Yes, for sure. This is what happens when you ask for more police powers.
Yep.
They obviously misuse them. So, yeah, I'm sure there'll be lots of cool news on that to come.
Speaking of police abusing powers, should we move on to our First Nations story?
Yes. So we've followed the story of Tanya Day, a Yorta Yorta woman who died in police custody after being arrested for public drunkenness for being asleep on a train. We followed that story for a while now as it kind of made its way through the coroner's court in Victoria. And the findings were released this week, the coroner's findings. So the headline here is that the coroner has referred the case to the Department of Public Prosecutions to determine whether criminal negligence has occurred. So that is a pretty big result. I think it came as a surprise to Tanya Day's family and their legal team. I don't think that they were expecting the coroner to say that there could potentially be a case for criminal prosecution against the police involved here. So that is a pretty positive development. April Day, Tanya Day's daughter, described the finding as bittersweet. She said she's grateful that the matter was referred to the Department of Prosecutions, but she was frustrated by the fact that the coroner found that the police hadn't been influenced by racism, which is one of the other sort of important things to mention in this finding. So this was a notable case because it was the first time that a coroner had been allowed to consider whether or not systemic racism had been a partial cause of death. And I think anybody who listens to and enjoys this show will know the obvious answer to that question when it comes to Indigenous deaths in custody. But it's a weird place to be in because she has to apportion individual blame when, of course, we understand, like, you know, it's in the name itself, systemic racism. Trying to pinpoint individual examples in specific cases where that has happened is going to be murky at best. But she did pin blame on the train driver who called the cops in the first place. And she found that he was acting with, quote-unquote, unconscious bias because Tanya Day was the only sleeping passenger that he'd ever called the cops to remove from a train, even though he comes across, he said, three sleeping passengers a week. So she found that he made a racist assessment and called the cops because Tanya Day was Aboriginal.
Yep.
But found that the cops arresting Tanya Day and throwing her in a cell
and
was
then
not
ignoring
because she was Aboriginal.
Her and not checking on her as they were legally obliged to do. That had nothing to do with her being Aboriginal. And in fact, she said that it was like a bias based on a stereotype of drunk people, I'm pretty sure.
It's
a bit of a weird
thing. The coroner was talking about, it shows, basically she reckons that, like, the cops were on record as having said a bunch of stuff about her being drunk,
right?
Not about her being Indigenous,
right?
And so she, you know, if you're talking about legally from a hard evidence perspective, she started talking, like, in her judgment, she was talking about it shows the dangers of stereotyping people, but she was talking about the dangers of stereotyping people on the basis that they are drunk, and like, obviously you shouldn't do that either, but it's just very strange that that was the angle it was taken there. And, like, it's worth noting as well that the cops earlier in the day found another severely intoxicated woman.
Who was not Aboriginal.
And instead of locking her up, they drove her home and she wasn't arrested or fined or anything. But despite that, the coroner couldn't find any evidence of systemic racism in the police's actions. But she did say that she reckons that there's a case for criminal negligence, potentially.
And that's based on the fact that the cops have an obligation to check on people in their cells. I think it's every 30 minutes or something like that. It's really regular.
Yep.
And they left it something like 4 hours. And she hit her head 5 times in the time that she was not checked on. And it was only after the last one that they eventually took her to hospital. So, yes, it seems like there might be a criminal negligence, or at least a possibility of that being found.
Yeah, which, like, obviously this is a potentially positive development for the Day family in seeking justice for Tanya's death. But obviously it also represents a whole new legal fight that they're now going to embark on, which is, I mean, look, it just sounds fucking exhausting to me, especially after how much they've already been through. So, look, power and solidarity to Tanya Day's family. Their advocacy around this has been inspiring, you know, especially considering everything that they've been through. So, you know, I hope that they can find some kind of justice for Tanya.
Should we move on to our next story, which is a little more lighthearted?
You fucked up.
I'll just quickly touch on this. We have another You Fucked Up winner from New South Wales. New South Wales state ministers just love winning You Fucked Up.
It's
they
like
can't help themselves.
A proud 3-decade history of fucking up in New South Wales state government.
They love it. So what's happened is the New South Wales Arts Minister, a guy called Don Harwin, has resigned after breaking COVID-19 regulations.
And in fact, he was fined.
He was fined.
Yeah.
after being photographed at his Central Coast residence, his holiday house, not where he actually lives. So one key thing to note here is in the ABC article about this is that he is described as quote-unquote embattled in the first sentence of the article, which I don't know if you've ever seen the political strife scale that goes all the way from colorful to disgraced.
Right,
but
right, right.
Embattled is pretty high up there. And, well, yeah, now he's had to resign. Yeah. I really like this quote from Gladys Berejiklian in the press conference that she gave after he tendered his resignation. She said, "During this health crisis, my government has asked the community to make greater sacrifices than all of us have ever had to make before." AKA, don't go to your fucking holiday house, bro?
Yeah.
Which, like, I understand that the, as we've discussed, the regulations are murky, and dude, Don Harwin claims that he made this trip before the, like, strict travel regulations came into place. So he still hasn't admitted that he's done anything wrong.
Yeah. He's resigned because he doesn't want to be a distraction, is what he said.
That's, the classic line, wheel him out. I just thought that was kind of funny.
Yep.
I don't really have much more of a take on it than that, other than we already know that politicians, and specifically New South Wales politicians, often behave as if they are above the law.
Yeah.
And now's not the fucking time. Okay. Like, honestly, he could have been doing, he probably has done a whole bunch of other much shadier shit in his time as minister. But right now, basically, it's just an optics thing. Like, the government really can't be seen to have members of its own party
ignoring their rules.
Yeah, like, very obviously flaunting the regulations that they are only just managing to get people to agree to, like, the general public.
Yeah.
Like, no one's happy about it, bro. If I had a fucking Central Coast holiday house, like, I'd be sad that I couldn't go there too. But look, you know, as Gladys says, we all got to make sacrifices in this trying and uncertain time. So anyway, Don Harwin, you're fucked up.
That must mean it's time for
Shitpost of the Week.
And this week we have, you know, listeners, we sometimes distinguish between shitposts and shitposts. And this week we have a really shit post. And it's shit on a number of levels. This was posted in the group by Celeste Arenas. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce her last name. Arenas?
Arenas, I reckon.
Who is a landlord and is like a professional landlord / real estate agent, but also used to work for the Institute of Public Affairs as their, like, campus outreach officer or something, which is just like a delicious glacé cherry on top of this shitpost sundae. I hate glacé cherries, but anyway. She posted this horrible Stone Toss meme. And listeners, probably many of you know who Stone Toss is, and probably many of you don't. He is a literal Nazi who makes comics. And you've probably seen some of his cartoons online. They've got a pretty, like, I hate to admit it, but the visual aesthetic is very useful and appropriate for, like, internet content. It's kind of a lot of, like, four-panel memes of people doing stuff, talking about things, and then at the end it's like, oh, gay people are pedophiles or whatever, you know. There's also a big anti-Stone Toss community online. There's a Reddit called Antifa Stone Toss where people edit his cartoons to be anti-fascist instead of pro-fascist. Anyway, and by the way, when I say he's a Nazi and that sort of thing, like, I'm not exaggerating. He's a literal, full-on white supremacist, like, anti-gay, like, unashamed Nazi dude. So I'm not being metaphorical here. Anyway, so this is a cartoon that he's done that Celeste or someone else edited slightly. They took his name out of the cartoon, which is a common thing when people are trying to slightly distance themselves from this particular Nazi artist. And it seems like there might have been one or two other very mild edits to the text to make it very slightly less fashy. But anyway, the comic goes like this. There's two people standing together. People who support the Tories, people who normally dislike the Tories, and they're shaking hands, and it says, hoping Boris Johnson gets well soon. And then both of them look annoyed off to the distance, and there's a figure who is, I don't know, how would you describe that person, Zach? They've got a hunchback and, like, weird legs and missing teeth.
Yeah, it's
and
just
stuff.
Like a deeply ableist
yes.
stereotype of a stupid person. Like, that's what...
Yeah.
That's what he's drawn here. It kind of looks like, if you've ever seen the movie 300, there's that, like, one hunchback guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just very... It's just disgusting. It's fucking horrible.
Yep. And
if you didn't know the guy was a Nazi, this is still such a obviously horribly ableist template. Sorry, go on.
Anyway, this stereotyped person says, "I hope he dies," and they're labeled salty Facebook Celts and angry Twitter people with dyed hair. And this is, so the Celts thing is why we think that this was probably mildly edited, because apparently there's, I didn't know about this until this post, but there's a subculture of like white supremacists who are Anglo supremacists who think that the Celtic like people of England are like genetically inferior, and that the Angles who invaded and took over are like the real whites that we should be supremacists about. So anyway, hilarious.
That's the beautiful thing about whiteness. You can constantly redefine it to exclude anybody you want and include yourself.
Yes.
It's a great system.
So anyway, Celeste copped the ban. I suspect she got to our group because there have been people in Ozpol shitposting trolling the Landlords Australia group, which, you know, good on you guys. Keep up the good work. But yeah, I think this was like very mild and hilarious splashback.
Like, why, when people try to raid us, is it always so fucking pathetic?
Yeah.
Like, please up your fucking game if you want to come and sling your bullshit, ableist, horrible, racist memes. Like, this, it's just, it's not a good example. It's not even, it's a terrible example even of a conservative meme. Uh-huh. Just done a very bad job of trying to troll the group. Like, and it's not even Ozpol.
Yep.
Like, that's the other thing that, like, and yeah, I mean, apparently Boris is out of the ICU, so
yeah,
Celeste is probably
gonna be
having
fine.
A great, great long weekend.
Anyway.
And so also, go on.
I was going to say, that was our shit post. I felt like we've talked about this particular Nazi comic enough.
Yes.
Yep. But now we have a shit post, which I guess is technically a shit post of the week of our heart. Aw. And this was made by Massimiliano S. Max? Thanks, Max.
J.S.
J.S. Sorry, yeah. I mean, I know what his actual name is, so I'm not sure how secret that is. But anyway, thanks, Max. This one is of that genre of, like, terrifying fantasy art. And so there's this, like, one person with a scythe and a spear or something, very, very small in the bottom right-hand corner, labeled, "Me entering 2020 feeling positive and thinking I'll achieve my goals." And then basically 100% of the rest of the picture is this enormous skeleton climbing over this cliff, clearly about to attack the character in the bottom right, labeled COVID-19. And then there's a bunch of other labels on it, like climate change, collapse of industry, economic depression, regular depression, Trump re-election, Joe Biden for prez, eco-fascists, Bernie suspends campaign, bushfires, Pell Walks 3, fake news, and a couple
those
of
are all
a bit
like-
too small.
Those are all a bunch of
tiny skeletons,
like, little skeletons who all have swords and shields
that are standing on the big skeleton, also attacking me entering 2020 feeling positive. Yeah,
I love these like heavy metal extreme fantasy meme templates. They're great, and yeah, I think we can all relate to this. Max, everyone is trying to stay positive in the face of all this shit, but hey, look. You know, you've got your scythe and
whatever that other thing is,
a spear or a quiver of arrows strapped to your back. But hey, give them hell.
Yeah, keep up the good memes as well.
So, Max mentions here that Pell has walked free. So, I think that's probably a good segue into our mains this week. So, we're going to be talking about the Pell case. So if this is something that you don't want to hear about, I reckon you should probably stop listening now.
Yes, we will have a tiny little bit of conclusion at the end, but that's basically, we're going to be talking about Pell for the rest of the episode. So
yeah,
if you're not into that, yeah, maybe check out.
Yeah, definite content warning for child sexual abuse. So yeah, I'm sure that everybody is relatively familiar with the case, but we'll just go over the details briefly. That George Pell was accused of raping two choir boys after Mass in 1996. And he was convicted of that in 2018 in Victoria. after that conviction. So he was found guilty by a jury. And then after that, he appealed to the Victorian Court of Appeals, where his appeal was denied by 2-1 by the judges. And then finally, he took it to the High Court, the highest court in Australia, where the judges unanimously found, all seven of them, that the jury couldn't have found him guilty without some reasonable doubt. They found that they should have found reasonable doubt and therefore shouldn't have convicted. So the other kind of element of this judgment from the High Court is that they found that the witness himself, who claimed to have been raped by Pell, they said that he was credible and reliable. I'll just read this like quote from the judgment, which sums it up. Notwithstanding that the jury found A to be a credible and reliable witness, the evidence as a whole was not capable of excluding a reasonable doubt as to the applicant's guilt. So I guess the point here is that it comes down to a relatively technical legal distinction that they're making here.
Which it always has to an appeal, right? So, like, neither of us are lawyers, so listeners, feel free to correct us. But I'm pretty sure all appeals have to be on points of law, as if there was some kind of miscarriage of justice rather than the facts being wrong. And so that's what the appeal was based on, was that the jury hadn't met the standard of reasonable doubt.
Yes, but at the same time, the High Court acknowledged that the witness was
basically telling the truth. Yeah.
So this is a very weird, it's a very weird kind of paradoxical decision to hand down, and I think a lot of people are probably feeling confused and upset by it.
Mm.
At the same time, I imagine that a lot of people are feeling like this is ultimately a very predictable result.
Yes.
That it's amazing that the case even made it this far to begin with, because of course, when you have essentially unlimited resources, you can get your case sent up and appeal to literally the highest court in Australia. Of course, there would be thousands and thousands and thousands of people whose cases would probably be whose convictions would be overturned on appeal to the High Court.
Yeah.
But they'd never have the resources to get there. So, you know, I guess it's also part of the ongoing pattern of total impunity for members of the Catholic Church who have committed abuse. Now, we can't say that we think Pell was guilty, but we can definitely
heavily
argue,
imply that.
we can definitely say that, like, we know that the Catholic Church is an institution absolutely rife with abuses, and that very, very few people have ever been held accountable for the abuse committed by that institution.
And we also know that Pell has been personally involved in moving priests who have abused people out of their parishes and into other ones where they won't be held accountable and where they'll be able to avoid scrutiny.
Yeah, he wasn't fucking acquitted of that.
No. Another thing, actually, is that the people who were the prosecution have said that they might try and go for a civil case against Pell. So this was a criminal trial, but it's possible that they might be able to have the same complaints upheld in a civil court where the standard of evidence is different.
Yeah. So, look, as Noon said, neither of us are legal people, and it's probably beyond our capabilities to discuss the legal intricacies of this particular case, but I also don't know if that's really a helpful way to approach this anyway. Mm. You know, I think that we, like most people, had a pretty strong emotional reaction to this news. I feel frustrated, angry. I feel so upset on behalf of not only the complainants in this case, but everybody who's been victimized by the Catholic Church.
And other sorts of sexual violence as well. Like, I mean, this is just yet another example of the courts completely being incapable of holding anyone to account for any kind of sexual violence or assault or harassment or anything like that.
Yeah, we know that conviction rates for sexual assault in general, but especially sexual assault of children, conviction rates are extremely low. It's really hard to even get the police to take the accusations seriously in the first place. It's another really important thing to mention. And like, if we're, you know, it's probably more useful to talk about the structure of the legal system as a whole being, you know, the things that it has set up as its fundamental building blocks when it comes to the concept of reasonable doubt, for example, or a trial by a jury of your peers. These are things that seem, I guess, on the face of it, like they would help create an objective and fair justice system. But in fact, they are stacked against victims of sexual assault because juries and people in general don't understand the issue very well to begin with. And there's, you know, the way that the system is set up so that defendants don't have to give evidence, but accusers are often put on the stand and then dismantled and forced to relive their trauma.
Aggressively cross-examined.
Yeah. Of course, the weird thing in this particular case is that the jury actually believed the witness.
Yeah.
And in the face of, like, contradictory evidence as well. So this isn't exactly applicable in this case, but obviously it's still a systemic issue that is, you know, widespread across all the legal systems in all of the states. But it also goes to show that even if you manage to overcome those hurdles, you find a jury that does believe you, that the legal system is still stacked massively in favor of people who wield massive amounts of wealth and institutional power.
Yeah, I think there's this sort of bias that we have that's kind of like a bias of default, I guess, that we kind of assume that all of our institutions are fine until there's proof otherwise. And so, I mean, this week we've, you know, Bernie has just dropped out of the race in the US and now we're left with a choice between Biden and Trump and so on. And sorry to get into us poll, and I realize like politics and child sexual assault so it's different, but you know, the structures are constantly disappointing us, and yet it's so hard to really believe that they're fundamentally flawed. And like, you know, I'm a communist, I think we should get rid of our fucking parliament and shit, but like, it's, I still have this default view that probably our courts and parliament are like reasonably effective tools. And it, this is just like yet another piece of evidence that it's not, and that they aren't adequate tools for delivering justice or for investigating events, or for, they're not egalitarian either. As you say, the whole system is structured to protect the wealthy and the powerful. And that's kind of always been the case. Me and Zach talked about this a bunch off air, but like, I don't really have any particular takes about George Pell. As you say, it's like awful and upsetting and terrible and disappointing and bad, but like, I don't really have any specific opinions about the case beyond that, you know? But I did look into the history of courts, and they're pretty fucked. Like, they're basically a 2,500-year-old institution based on Roman law in the 5th century BC. And it's been, like, edited and updated repeatedly since then, but every 500 years or so, someone finds this thing called the Code of Justinian, which was written in about 500 AD, and then, like, rewrites all of the laws and legal systems to match that again. And that's happened, like, 5 or 6 times in the history of courts. But, and yeah, Zach kind of said maybe a lesson on the history of courts is not the most appropriate response to this, and I totally accept that, and I don't want to go into a huge amount of detail, but I just wanted to give one example of the ways in which the courts are systemically biased towards the powerful. And the origin of the common law was in England in the 1100s, and it was called common because it was the same law for all of the courts. Previously, there were like local courts or like justice systems that would have been, you know, basically different from one another, and the king was like, no, we need to have a common law to all of these different areas. And one of the things that was a common practice before the common law was a trial by ordeal, and so someone would be forced to burn their hand, so they'd have to pick like a rock out of boiling water, or they'd have to hold a like hot sword that had been stuck in a fire or whatever, and if the hand started healing within 3 days, they were found innocent. And King William II tried 50 men who'd been accused of poaching his deer by trial by ordeal, and they all got let off. And so he was like, fuck, I can't let this keep going. I need to change the law. And it wasn't designed for fairness or justice. It was because some dude was mad that his deer got nicked by the peasants. And he was like, fuck, the courts can't help me get mad at these poor people. I'm going to change the entire legal system so that my deer are safe. Yeah, so that's just like one little thing. But the history of churches and religious people being exempt slash avoiding legal, you know, justice or whatever is also extensive. Because up until about the 1600s, the church had an entirely separate court system, and basically all priests were tried in that system and not in the secular courts. And so from the point of view of canon law, which is what the church law is called, the problem with sexual misconduct is not that it has hurt someone, or not that someone has been assaulted or anything like that. The issue is a spiritual one, which is that the priest has committed a sin. And that's sort of legalistically, from the church's point of view, what the problem with sexual assault is. Which really, like, I think sets the tone for the last couple hundred years of church abuse of various sorts. And in fact, confessional booths were originally invented to stop priests abusing people who had come to them to confess sins. So anyway, that's a little interesting. That was in about the 1500s. Basically, as soon as we have record, as soon as confession started being a regular thing instead of like a deathbed confession, immediately we have records of priests abusing people, mostly adult women, in fact. But anyway, so the remedy that the church would have for sexual misconduct were like things that responded to the concept of sin. So things like a lifetime of penance or an act of faith, like a pilgrimage or like going to live in a monastery or that sort of thing, but not anything that deals with the victim or the damage that's been caused. It's a purely sort of spiritual approach. And canon law has this idea of a scandal, which is a technical term, which means when a sin is made worse by becoming public, right? And again, this logic has just led to the church trying to keep things as quiet as possible, avoid any kind of public culpability or anything like that, because they want to stop the sin turning into a scandal. And like, yeah, I think obviously those like legal structures are no longer in place in modern Australia. But the history of the courts and the history of the church and their like conceptual framework for dealing with sexual assault is fundamentally one that protects the powerful, protects the priests, and doesn't give a fuck about the victims.
It's definitely easy to see this as another in a long line of examples of the church being a law unto itself.
Mm.
And, you know, until recently there were, you know, the laws were different, but until very recently you couldn't sue Catholic dioceses because they were an unincorporated organization. So they did still basically have laws that protected them from any kind of legal challenge on these kinds of issues. Mm. And I don't know. I mean, the legal stuff is one side of it, but as you say, even though the laws change over time, like the societal attitudes about these things are ultimately going to dictate the way that our institutions respond to them. And I think that that is kind of key to the problem here, because the mechanics of our legal system and the High Court in particular in this case are one thing, and they are definitely super problematic in many ways, as we've discussed, but ultimately they're a reflection of the society that they exist in.
Mm.
And if we really valued finding real justice and for victims of sexual assault, there are so many things that we could do to change the way that our court systems function in order to achieve that, but they're just not being done. But as you say, I mean, look, there's a question about whether or not you can reform a system that is, like, in this country, fundamentally illegal to begin with, given that, you know, it was founded on genocide and the lie of terra nullius. Whether, you know, there's a question about whether or not you can actually effectively reform a system like that, but ultimately that's what we've got to work with.
Yeah,
but we're operating within a society in which, you know, there was huge, huge public support for Pell from all across the right-wing media throughout this entire trial. And as soon as the High Court judgment came down, Andrew Bolt was on his blog and he was ranting on Sky News about how this is one of the greatest miscarriages of justice that Australia has ever seen, about how George Pell has been declared completely innocent and absolved of all crimes. And those things are just not true. Aside from the fact that George Pell got the most amount of justice he possibly could have get, he went to the fucking High Court and was acquitted. He was given absolutely every opportunity to appeal and ultimately was found not guilty. But also this sort of attempt to use this as a vindication of Pell and his history within the church, because as we touched on, like, we know that he has been involved in the way that the church dealt with pedophile priests in the past. And, you know, he has known about this. Like, he's clearly known about this and has done nothing. And he is fucking culpable for that. And maybe, we don't have a legal system that can hold him accountable for that. But societally, we have to. We have to do that work. And when we have the most popular, the most read columnist in Australia using his platform to consistently defend people who have been accused of sexual assault, because it's not just Pell. Only weeks ago, Bolt had someone on his show talking about the St. Kevin's scandal in high school in Melbourne, where a sports coach was accused of grooming a teenage boy. And, yeah, Pell had a guy on, and they were talking about how, quote-unquote, it was not that bad. Like, this is a through line of Australia's mainstream right-wing media, like, downplaying and waving away the sexual assault of children. It's still a view held by many people in Australian society and Australian media in particular.
Mm.
And, yeah, I mean, it's a deeply frustrating problem, and just like the pain, the psychological and emotional pain and suffering of this moment to me is inconceivable. I can't. There's no way that you can that I could personally begin to understand that. So, you know, I guess I just want to send out, you know, my sympathy to anybody who is feeling deeply affected by this, because you deserved better. And the complainant in this case deserved better.
Yeah.
And everybody who, you know, who has been affected by this, by the Catholic Church in particular, deserved better, you know. But the Royal Commission found that 5,000 people had made allegations of abuse against the church by 2017. That's the most of any of the institutions that were looked at in the Royal Commission about the institutional response to child sexual assault. So this is definitely a problem that is bigger than Pell and bigger than our legal system, but that's where we're at. You know, we our broken institutions are continuing to fail to deliver, and until we do something really radical to try and amend that, it's hard to see it changing.
Mm. Well, I think that might be enough about that. Maybe before we end, we can try and have a little slightly nicer end to the show with
Positivity Corner.
We asked for submissions for this week's Positivity Corner, and we didn't get any, and that is fair enough, because it's been an absolutely shithouse couple of weeks, as we have just discussed. So, fair enough. But I wanted to share a little something that's been putting a smile on my face over the last couple of weeks, which is a podcast called Spooky Speaks, which I just can't recommend highly enough. I haven't laughed so much in a long time listening to this show. This is a show featuring Spooky, Australia's favorite political chihuahua. She's the former treasurer of Australia, and her co-host is her daddy, Jack, who is an absolute sweetheart. I do happen to know the people who make this show, yes, IRL, and they're both big cuties. But this, yeah, it's just a very funny, totally absurd, extremely weird, and often psychopathic podcast that I have just been absolutely loving and can't recommend highly enough. So check them out on Spotify or you know wherever else you get your podcasts. You can find them everywhere. That's Spooky Speaks.
I've got a little positivity corner as well, which was that it was my birthday this week. You know, I've spent many years lying to people about when my birthday is and how old I am and trying to discourage people from celebrating it too much. And I think this year I might have gone a little too far. I made a little Facebook post about canceling birthdays. And I got a bunch of messages from people on my birthday being like, oh, hey, I'm really sorry, but happy birthday. I hope it's not too crappy or whatever. It's not like I've got a huge... It's not, you know, the birthdays are super traumatic for me. I just find them a bit stressful and can't be bothered and so on. But anyway, it's nice. Yeah, it was a nice day. I had some nice times, got some nice wishes. One of our patrons, Jess, sent me a cafe brunch via Uber Eats, which was very sweet. Aww. Thanks, Jess. Yeah, anyway, that's nice. That was just a nice little thing in my week.
Happy birthday, bud.
Thanks.
I'm glad it was an okay one.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. I hope that this wasn't too dark of a show. I mean, it's dark times, I guess. That's how it is. Yeah, if you know you like what we do, please support us by leaving a review or sharing us with a friend or joining up on Patreon if you can and want to. We'd really appreciate it.
Plus, you'll get those Marxist meme content soon.
Yes, it is on the way. Cool.
All right.
Make sure that you keep on snacking in the free world.
And don't forget to crunch.